Previously on Documenta and Son.
What I'm angry at is this very simplified idea of queerness, where the just presence of a queer character or artist automatically makes something queer, when really this show is fucking frightened of queerness. And welcome to a special Signal House edition of Documenta and Son, being the adventures of a dad who's gay and a son who is figuring shit out. My name is Documenta Barbarism. For a Marine, I'll show more.
And I'm Dingle Mary, an abundance of Tic Tacs.
You call this an abundance of Tic Tacs? It's a Drag Race reference from this week, in case you don't know. And on this very special edition of the wait, what are we doing? Documenta and Son. We got a special guest.
Hi. Hello.
Founding editor of the Signal House edition and lots of other cool shit. Melissa Chamber.
Hello. Thank you for talking to me on the computer.
It's so nice to have you here in the computer. So, Mel, may I call you Mel?
Sure.
Mel and I go way back, well, about 7 years, actually.
Yeah, about that now.
To London. Mel was actually on, last week I talked about the time that we were, that our friends went and found weed in Brussels, and I was hallucinating the Idaho-Montana border.
What do you mean, weed? That's against the law. I would never do anything like that. To be clear, I was not.
Were you?
I was not part of the weed gathering, nor did I smoke any weed at any point in time.
That's what I was going to say, because I remember it was just the three of us, and you had just gone to bed early or something.
Yeah, I know. I wasn't even there. I heard about it afterwards. Yeah, that was
why were you just being a party pooper?
No, I'm kidding. I was there. I saw the whole thing. That was a good time. That was a good time. Belgium is a good place to go when you're doing a degree that you don't understand with a group of your friends to do something fun instead. That's what we did.
Literally, it was just like three like blazing days.
Yeah.
Days of like theater going and jumping on buses and going to places.
Yeah.
And it was pretty amazing. Awesome.
Yeah, that resulted in a really high quality research project for which we got a distinction, sound effect.
Yeah. So Mel, tell the listeners a bit about yourself.
Ooh, I'm currently visiting New York City, which is a strange time to come because Omicron is raging. I lived here for a very long time. I lived here from 2008 to 2014, which maybe doesn't sound so long, but New York years are like cat years or dog years. They go for eons. And then I lived in London for the past 7 years. I'm a theater maker. I have a theater company called The Signal House with playwright Kit Brookman, and also together with some other fantastic folk, namely Henry Martin and Erica Gillingham, we founded The Signal House Edition in 2020, when theater was not the coolest thing to be doing.
Well, theater's never been the coolest thing to be doing, but I take your point.
Why didn't we just make movies? So that's who I am. I'm a theater maker and a writer and editor, and I'm really pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're so pleased to have you. That sounded really disingenuous.
Let's go for that again. How pleased?
So pleased, dude. It's just so nice. Just love you so much. No, Mel is truly one of my dearest friends. Pretty much the only friend from that time that I still talk to regularly. My London year was amazing, but also a pretty solitary time for me. I was still coming out of the shell of familyhood and parenthood and Mormondom that you trapped me in, Dingle Mary.
Stop laying the blame on me.
So I was mostly going to a lot of theater, but I'd sort of lucked into this project, this research project group with Mel and a couple other wonderful people. And that really changed the whole, how the back half was much better than the front half.
Yeah.
Which actually is the same, holds true for my body as well.
Let us not forget.
Back half is better than the front half.
And where are you from originally, since Americans love to ask that?
I am from Australia. I grew up in Brisbane. Yeah.
Yay.
That's the whole story.
And even though you and I have done educational work together and worked on the Signal House edition as well, you've actually done more creative work with Dingle Mary.
Oh, this is true. This is true. Just yesterday, yes, we were looking at a photograph of Dingle Mary and myself in an actual closet.
It was closet practice.
It was the proto closet practice. What seems like hundreds of years ago, when Dingle Mary was a tiny, tiny boy, he was involved.
So small and cute.
He was involved in a site-specific sound piece that I made on Governor's Island in New York with an artist called Candace Thompson. And Dingle Mary came along and helped us out, being the voice of a child. Who was charged with telling an Arctic?
It was a real stretch.
Yeah, at the time he sounded like a child. Being a child who was telling us an Arctic adventure story, and I made the possible error of asking Dingle Mary to write said story. And so this child was left alone in the upstairs room of an empty old house.
It was a really hot day too.
Yeah, while his father and I went on a lovely walk around Governor's Island, and we came back, and despite all of the ideas I planted in his mind about, you know, lost explorers and ice and polar bears and seals and things like that, basically what he wrote was all about Nazis. There was more Nazi content in there than I ever thought would be consistent with. I don't even think the Nazis ever went to the North Pole. It's the only place they didn't go is the North Pole. And yet in
as
Dingle
far Mary, as you know.
Yeah, so the story that Dingle Mary's told in that closet was a lot about Nazis and a lot of Pepsi Cola. But it was a classic collab. It was a good time.
Oh, I love that. That's adorable. Well, Mel, we look forward to many adventures to come, hopefully not involving Nazis.
Hopefully not.
So as has now become the tradition, we're going to ask you some gay trivia.
Oh, cool.
How do you feel about that?
Oh, great. Yeah, okay.
So, and as just a reminder, we're doing it. This is the Gay Trivia Quiz Book from 1985. Mm. So a lot of the information is a bit sketchy.
Yeah.
It's not always the most reliable, but it also is a really interesting reflection of prejudices and understandings of the time.
Okay.
You know, this was just like a few years into the AIDS epidemic and things. Uh-huh. So. All right. Here we go. I know I said you were going to, but then I changed my mind.
Bruh.
Did I not tell you that I was? Okay. Here we go. One magazine was published by One Inc., an organization formed to protect the rights of homosexuals. It was distributed through the mails until October 1954, before it was A, halted because One Inc. had disbanded after a tremendous amount of infighting, B, pulled from the mail by the postmaster of Los Angeles, C, stopped from further production because right-wing groups such as the John Birch Society had destroyed its printing presses in a riot,
whoa,
or D, discontinued due to a lack of funding.
All of these are bad.
I'm going to go for destroying of the things in a riot.
That does sound lovely. That's very 19th century, though. Unfortunately, the answer is B.
Oh!
It was pulled from the mail by the postmaster of Los Angeles.
Oh, see,
he withdrew it.
Okay.
What?
Wow, the postmaster had that kind of clout?
I know, weird, huh?
What are the postmasters doing?
People used to actually give a shit about the mail.
Yeah, what are they doing nowadays? What things haven't got through the post that the postmaster? I'm the postmaster. You may not post this.
Well, during the former guy's presidency, he was trying to dismantle the post office, basically.
That's right.
Whoa.
So he has been very busy.
Oh, God.
Yeah, for some reason, the right has really sort of latched on to the post office as a I don't know, socialist conspiracy or something that needs to be destroyed.
That's eccentric. I mean, eccentric is a word, isn't it? There are plenty of other ones.
Yes.
All right, next one. I got that wrong. Okay, so is the postmaster.
Well, actually, they do have a little interesting explanation here. In 1955, the district court decided that the magazine was non-mailable since, quote, the stories are obviously calculated to stimulate the lust of the homosexual reader.
Which you should never do.
No, we do not want to be stimulating the lust. It was later appealed, and actually they went before the Supreme Court and won.
Oh, cool.
In 1958.
That's awesome.
So it was considered perhaps the first significant Supreme Court victory by the increasingly vocal homosexual community.
Right on.
Too vocal. IMHO.
Wow.
Sometimes I wish they would just shut up.
Take that, postmaster.
Yeah,
you just
it.
You just got gay mastered.
Oh, we really do need sound effects.
We do. We need a soundboard so bad.
All right. What was the Okay, this is going to be wrong, probably. What was the stereotypical profession for gay men during the 1800s in America? A. Haberdasher. B. Barber. C. Theater manager. D. Variety store clerk.
Notably, postmaster is not one of those options.
Interesting.
I want it to be haberdasher. Can it be haberdasher?
Is that your guess?
Yeah.
The answer is D. The variety store clerk was the prototype of today's hairdressers, florists, and interior decorators. They were called counter jumpers because it was said they would leap over the counters to wait on attractive male customers. Now that I believe.
A variety store clerk. What is a variety store? Just a variety of things, I suppose. It's written on the tin. A variety store sells a variety of things. Food? Clothing?
So it's interesting that they say they're the prototype of hairdressers, florists, and interior decorators, because I'm trying to think of a store that would combine the three.
If it doesn't exist, let's open it. Let's start that.
Yes, the variety store.
Yes.
Because I'm thinking, you know, like variety shows.
Yeah. Maybe it's so variety. It's variety in that it's like every day they're selling a different thing. You never know what they're going to be selling. Today it's shoes. Yeah. Tomorrow it could be popcorn. Now it's...
And the day after?
Toothpick.
Their ass.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's better.
Yeah. For instance.
For instance, just to pick something off the top of my head. All right. What king was forced to witness the beheading of his gay lover, which had been ordered by his father? Oh, no.
Oh, God.
A, King George II. B, Alexander the Great. C, Frederick the Great. D, King Juan Carlos I.
Juan Carlos.
You are wrong again.
What?
C, Frederick the Great.
All right. In my defense, this is something that no one would know.
I know. Absolutely. King of Prussia from 1740 to 1786 was forced to watch the decapitation of his lover, Hans von Katte, by order of Frederick's father, Frederick William, who had been appalled by his heir's blatant love affair with Katte. Just before Katte was decapitated, however, the young Frederick blew him a kiss and begged forgiveness. Then he fainted and was spared seeing the actual decapitation. That's the gayest thing ever.
It is.
Oh, no, I'm fainting.
Don't make me watch it.
Dear Hans. That's terrible. We shouldn't joke about that.
I know. There's nothing like a decapitation story for a good old lol.
It's all right. It's outside of the, what's that, the period called with the statute of limitations.
Good job.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
All right. What term was used during the 1950s as a euphemism for homosexual by those who wanted to fight the stereotype that homosexuals were obsessed with sex? A, gay, which is still in use today.
Yeah.
It says that. B, queer, preferred by neoconservative homosexual men because it highlights the fact that they are different. C, queen, or D, homophile.
Queer.
As D, homophile.
Ah!
Which was used because the suffix "phile" was supposed to suggest that homosexuality was more an emotion than a sexual attraction, that homosexuals were interested in love more than sex, just like heterosexuals. Still that same thing that I'm always complaining about.
Yeah.
Love is love is love is love is love.
Stop complaining. God.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I'd only heard I thought the term homophile applied to the organizations like One Inc. and stuff, and like the Daughters of Bilitis that were actually like fighting for like gay rights and stuff. I didn't realize that was actually used for the people.
Yeah.
Huh.
That is interesting.
Okay. Two more. The last half of this century saw the publication of a book that was considered a landmark because, for the first time, it presented homosexuals as a minority deprived of rights and status by a prejudiced society. What was the name of the book? A. The Politics of Homosexuality by Toby Murata. B. The Homosexual in America by Donald Webster Corey. C. The Oscar Wilde Handbook by Bruce Fallis. Something tells
that
me it's not that.
That is absolutely a pseudonym.
Yeah.
That is absolutely
I'm pretty sure they made it up. Mm-hmm. Or D, The Homosexual Matrix by C.A. Tripp.
With a foreword in the new edition by Keanu Reeves.
Yes.
I don't know why. I'm feeling it for B.
Burr, 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 burr. Wow. It's B, The Homosexual in America by Donald Webster Corey.
It was a triple. Yeah.
We usually.
It was a triple barrel name for some reason. For some reason, the triple barrel name. And we go, that's the right one.
We usually like mistake our way into one or two right ones every time.
Yeah, that's what I've done right there. Triple barreled names. Good segue, by the way, to what people don't know we're going to talk about next.
Why do these rednecks always have three names?
Why?
Gives me chills.
Yep.
All right, last one. On which date did 8 police officers set out and fail to close the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in Greenwich Village, thanks to the patrons who fought back? And then in parentheses, for some reason, the ensuing riot marks the birth of the gay liberation movement. No, it sure doesn't, but go off, sis. The gay liberation movement had been raging for a couple decades before that, but you do you, New York gays of 1985.
Yeah. Wait, no one died at Stonewall?
I guess I should read the answers.
You're thinking of a different Stonewall.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
A, June 27th, 1969. B, July 21st, 1968. C, June 23rd, 1969. Or D, August 2nd, 1970.
The first one.
June 27th, 1969.
Correct.
That is correct.
That is correct.
Yes.
There we go. I'm glad I got that one. I wouldn't be a proper semi-New Yorker if I didn't know the date that happened.
No.
No.
Did you know there was a drag queen kick line at the riot?
Oh, I did not, but thank you for telling me that.
Isn't that just wonderful to picture? Just like shit is going down and there's just drag queens just going, kick line
da,
right
da,
in
the- da, 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 da.
Yeah,
so much that. Bloodshed. Okay, well- Yet so much fabulous at the same time.
Well, yeah, you did pretty great, actually.
Yeah.
Better
than I do.
One lucky guess and one thing that would be embarrassing not to know. I think, that's okay.
Better than Dingle Mary.
Exactly. There we go.
All right, let's take a break, shall we?
Okay.
Let's.
If you live in the greater New York area or have a good microphone and would like to share your story on Closet Practice, anonymously or not, message me on Twitter at DocumentaB, on Instagram at DocumentaBarbarism, online at DocumentaBarbarism.com, or by email to buttstuff@DocumentaBarbarism.com. With only one A in barbarism. That's DocumentaBarbarism. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe to House of Barbarism on your pod thingy of choice so you don't miss a single episode of Adventures in Gaby Sitting and Closet Practice every Monday, and Documenta and Son every Thursday.
Yeah, remember how they tell the story about how the original TV flipper committed suicide by just like,
oh yeah,
couldn't live anymore. So it just like sank to the bottom of the pool and died.
What? Stop laughing. This is not a fun story. It's true though. Yeah, dolphins are the only other species that commit suicide.
They're also dark.
I know this. They're also the only other species to have sex for pleasure. I know this too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
They're the most like us.
That's interesting.
And I think
they're going to be our overlords.
Exactly.
And I think they're bisexual or can be gay, but I think not exclusively gay. It's not like there are some gay dolphins and some stray dolphins.
Oh, they just like all are?
No, well, yeah, I don't know. This is something to do. This is for a future podcast. The sex life of dolphins.
Yes.
Yes. Absolutely.
All right. Shall we get back into it now?
Let's do it.
Ugh, fine.
Okay. Welcome back. I was going to say dudes, but then I was afraid the last thing. Welcome back, y'all.
Everyone.
No.
Welcome back, listener.
Dad confirmed. Dad cannot do trucker radio anymore.
Yep. There goes my ham radio license.
It was a good dream.
Okay. It was a good dream. Well, the reason that Mel is joining us today is because we all had the pleasure yesterday of seeing the latest production of Stephen Sondheim's Assassins, a classic stage company.
Yes, it was awesome.
It was. It's true.
And it was awesome. And I created the metaphor yesterday, and I'm sticking with it, that if any of you remember those aerobics videos from the 80s and 90s, there were different impact levels. The high impact was the instructor, the Jane Fonda. You had the medium impact on a tall block doing like half energy, and then the low impact on the short block in the back, like barely moving. Actually, the movement doesn't – I don't know why I keep bringing that up. That has nothing to do with the metaphor, and it actually muddies the water. So I'm just going to cut that out. But in this case, it applies because – I have been a Sondheim obsessive for 25 years. I've been in love with Assassins. My best friend had the cast recording on CD. We wore it out. I've seen it several times. Dingle Mary had never seen it, but was a little familiar with the music.
I've listened through it quite a few times.
Like on road trips and stuff. Yeah. And Mel had never seen, not only had she never seen it, but shockingly had never seen a single Sondheim show in performance.
Although, in weird twist, I have been in a Sondheim
production.
Yes, but yes, is also, and it was professional, right?
The Sondheim production I was in?
Yeah.
It was at drama school. So in my final year of acting school, I played Joanne in Company. Nothing like a nothing like a 20-year-old to really bring a drunk divorcee to life.
Does anybody still wear a hat?
The hardest line to say. The hardest line to say.
Really? Why?
Because no one else can do it but Elaine Page. Or no, Patty. True. Patty. Yeah. Who's the other one that played it? Patty.
Patty LuPone is playing her right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But Elaine Stritch was the originator, and
what did I say? Everyone. Elaine Page. Who's Elaine Page?
Elaine Page. She was the original Grisabella in Cats.
All right.
And she did Evita and stuff.
Okay.
She's the lesser of the two Elaines.
Wow. Shade.
At any rate, I have an experience of being on the inside of a Sondheim, but I've never seen one on stage. So this was an amazing event. In a lifetime of theater, good. I've somehow managed to not ever see a Sondheim.
Yeah, which is wild and mind-blowing. Mm. Especially because they seem to appreciate him even more in London, weirdly.
Do they?
But anyway, I get that feeling. They named a theater after him first, before we did anyway.
Oh, wow. Oh, there we are. Okay.
Wait, we have a theater named after him?
Yeah.
Where? Uh-huh.
It's I can't remember which one it used to be. It's a Broadway theater. You know what? Now that I say that, I'm going to roll that back. I don't know if there actually is a Sondheim Theater in London, but I remember there being a movement to name a Sondheim Theater. So I'm going to roll that back just in case.
Try look it up.
No, we don't have time.
Okay.
So let's start. Usually when we have guests, Dingle Mary just sort of sits there.
Yeah.
And his voice gets drowned out a bit. So let's hear from you first, Dingle. What did you think about it? Tell us about your experience.
It was, as we've said, the first time I'd ever seen Assassins.
Actually, tell us, the listeners, what it is.
Assassins is a musical by Stephen Sondheim. I butchered his name. It's about six assassins. It's sort of like a series of vignettes about seven?
I don't know the exact number, because then they mentioned some others. And
yeah, about a variety of presidential assassins. In America.
And would be assassins.
And it's just sort of them interacting and the reasons they shot or attempted to shoot the president. So, and it all builds up sort of as John Wilkes Booth tries to convince Blake Oswald. I can't
Lee
remember.
Harvey?
Lee Harvey Oswald to shoot JFK.
Yeah, that's the climax.
That's the climax.
All right, what'd you think of it?
I really liked it. The music was fun. It was very funny, even though the like topic was kind of dark.
Because the topic was
Because
dark.
The topic was dark, yeah. And they did have a lot of loud gun sound effects that hurt my boomer ears.
Yeah, you from the very first time you saw a gun, I saw those hands creeping up. I was like, stop it. Stop it. I knew it was going to be fine. They weren't even that loud.
They were. But I really liked it. I thought the acting was really good.
Any standouts to you?
SpongeBob.
SpongeBob, yeah. So the Ethan Slater, who was the balladeer, who then became Lee Harvey Oswald, played SpongeBob on Broadway.
Yeah.
In the SpongeBob musical.
Oh,
which
wow.
I could not think about any time. And he's there the whole time too. Like he's floating around the stage the whole time, and I'm just
with
like
his guitar.
And he kind of has that like weird smile he had on his face the whole time. I was just like,
yeah.
This is SpongeBob's Assassins. This is Assassins by Nickelodeon, and it's
I could not.
But you liked his performance?
Yeah, I thought he did really well.
Any others?
John Wilkes Booth was hot.
Okay, Stephen Pasquale.
Yeah,
you noticed he did some acting too. Did you?
No, no, yeah, he was okay as an actor, I think.
Really, you didn't?
No, I mean, like, I don't know. The only person that I, like, spent a lot of time, well, like, that was standout-ish to me, was SpongeBob.
What about the play as a whole?
The, I really liked the vignettes where the musicians got to sing as well, like, about how FDR is so lucky that I was here.
Oh,
so.
How I Saved Roosevelt?
Yeah, How I Saved Roosevelt.
Yeah, that's
which is such
song.
A good song.
Uh-huh. And because you know that melody is from John Philip Sousa March.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, the parts where they're singing, the parts where Zingara is in the electric chair, that's Sondheim's.
Yeah.
But the rest is a Sousa.
Yeah. And I was also surprised that they managed to get those few opening chords of Evita.
What?
They made a joke about Evita, and then it's like played as they transition to the next scene.
What the fuck are you talking about? Mel, can you help us out? Was there an Evita joke that I missed?
I cannot verify that. I'm sorry. I know there was a Death of a Salesman joke or a Death of a Salesman bit, and there's also a West Side Story bit, but I got Evita, that passed me by.
I mean, I've listened to the play. I've seen it several times. I've taught this play. I've never noticed the Evita joke. Well, what do you? But you also thought they were saying everybody's got the right to bear dreams,
which is a good pun for the record.
It is.
Is this like an optical illusion? Has Xander somehow seen Evita in Assassins in a way that no one has before? It's like the Jesus in the toast.
Yeah,
I truly
what
understand.
Part, what part was this that you're talking about?
It was like in the middle somewhere.
Okay, that's very helpful. Okay, well, and now you know why we don't hear from Dinklemary a lot on these episodes.
Shut up.
No, that's really interesting. See if you can, while we're talking, well, obviously you're going to be listening with rapt attention to everything we say, but see if you can remember specifically what part it was, because now I'm intrigued.
Yeah, we're going to come back to you on that. You've got some time to think.
All right, Mel, what'd you think?
I thought it was great. It was really great to be back in a theater I've seen in 2 years. I've seen basically three things before this. The most recent thing I saw in London was a 16-minute Carol Churchill play at the Royal Court, which seemed token. It wasn't bad. I didn't know why we were all there. For 16 minutes. I went to Broadway the other night under 10 masks and a light film of sanitizer all over my body and saw Slave Play, which was an incredible play, but very Broadway-y. And I know you guys had a whole discussion about that on a different podcast. So it was great to be back at Classic Stage Company, which I haven't been to in a really long time, but also be in a really solid, well-made piece of theater that couldn't be written by a better person. The performances were all wonderful. They were really connected. It was lovely that there was sort of theater in the round, kind of. And yeah, so I really, really loved being there. I was really swept away by it. A good musical, I think, will do that. And also it's a nice time to have that happen to you because as a theater maker, me and everybody else are thinking, well, what are we doing when we go back to this? When basically what we're asking to do is have people come in and see the thing that no one asked you to make and also risk their health. So why would you do that right now? And I think that this experience in the theater yesterday gave me the feeling of why theater is important, which is to do with communion more than anything else. And now I'm going to talk about masks. Am I allowed to talk about the masks?
Yes. She tried to bring up the masks yesterday. I was like, no, save it for the pod.
These guys wouldn't let me talk about the masks. So the thing is now entire audiences wear masks and we do that for public health reasons. And for a performer, that is very strange to look down off a stage and see a sea of masks or a sea of eyeballs and masks looking back at you. There was a choice made, a production slash scenography choice slash public health choice made to have performers who were often sat on the stage wearing masks when they weren't singing and weren't performing. Luckily, this tied in, I think, in a thematic way because a lot of the people, a theme of the show is that thing of, you know, the reason why you assassinate the president is because you are a silenced party and you just want to be heard. So there was something about seeing faces on stage that were effectively gagged that worked for the play. But also there was something I think really generous about doing that because everyone who gathered there to see the play was still risking their health. And there was something about having the performers acknowledging that everybody was there sharing a space at risk by covering their own faces. There was something, I think, generous about that. And also there was a kind of a dignity to it on the behalf of the piece of theater, I think. And this is something I think about because, you know, like everybody else, we had a show canceled when the pandemic happened and it's in our hands to reanimate that production and try and get it back on. But while it is a health risk for people to gather and watch your stuff, that just, you know, that makes me uneasy. And in this production, they made the choice to acknowledge the common world that we're all living in, which somehow didn't have the effect of ruining the magic of the thing, which I think is an amazing achievement.
So it's very tough to get a play to speak to the moment in a way that's not too heavy-handed or obvious or plotting.
Yeah.
And especially also because a mask is a really mundane object now, and it's a bit the same as putting... Like whenever you put a mobile phone on stage, you are making life very hard for yourself because it's a really mundane object. They're a black mirror. They're a vacuum. Normally what happens when someone pulls a smartphone out on stage, all the magic gets sucked out of the room. And before I saw Assassins, I would have thought that the same thing would have happened, but it didn't. The opposite did. I think it added to the sense of communion of us all being there and sharing the story. And so I thought it was great. I'm really surprised to say that, but the masks were one of the most compelling things about this show. And also the singing was great. But yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
And you know, they were American flag print as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like the flag is perhaps silencing them. Or they see the flag as something that silences them, that doesn't allow them to breathe.
Yeah.
And it also, in a way, possibly connects them to anti-maskers. You know, it puts them on a spectrum of crazy.
Yeah. And the story itself is so much to do with personal power and reclaiming personal power or the power you're given or that sort of thing. Like the song, just you pull your little finger or you have to just treat, what's the song?
Yeah, it's called The Gun Song.
The Gun Song, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
there's no pulling fingers. Don't pull a finger. The Gun Song, yeah. That's what it literally says is, you know, all it takes is this little thing and you are the most powerful person in the world. And a lot of, I think, the anti-vax movement and the anti-mask movement is all to do with this sort of, I want to use the word misconstrued personal power that people are sort of standing behind. But then again, and I only just recently had my first conversation with an anti-vaxxer in London, which is a story I told you yesterday. I'd never really had a long conversation with someone who'd made that choice before. And I realized that, yeah, if you've been continually pushed down by the system and you've been fucked around by the system, then when the system says, and now you have to do this, you might make the choice to take that, you know, to take that decision at everyone else's detriment. So, yeah, I think it worked well with that thing. Yeah. What did you think?
Do you remember? Well, we'll get into that in a second. Do you remember when Trump, when he caught COVID?
And
that's a little obvious.
I know.
When he caught COVID and was in the hospital and nearly died, but left the hospital too soon. Do you remember when he went back to the White House and he walked up those steps and stood out on that terrace and made a big performance of taking off his mask? I don't know if they were doing it on purpose, but the moment at the beginning when they all came forward at the start, and all at the same time took off their mask, they seemed to be mimicking Trump's posture and the movements, like taking it out. It was almost that defiant movement.
That's really smart. Moment. That's really, really smart.
I was wondering, I don't know, I could have just been reading that into it. But one of the issues with John Doyle's productions is it's something that's always bothered me, and something I finally gave it a name to yesterday, is what I call semiotic confusion. Ooh. He throws a lot of different like signifiers into his productions, and it's never quite clear what they mean. Like, he had the flag there, which is obvious, but then that red ribbon would come out every once in a while, whenever they were successful.
Yeah, whenever a president died.
Yes. Well, no, I get when it was being used. That's not what was confusing. But he likes to throw a lot into his productions that sometimes just muddy the experience.
Yeah. The way that Assassins – remind me when it was written. When was it first aged?
1990 at Playwrights Horizons. It's actually got an interesting production history, which I'll go into after you.
Oh, right. It has kind of an epic structure in an interesting way. And Xander used the word vignettes before, which I think is also true. But you know what's going to happen from the beginning is you're going to hear from all these different assassins. You get the whiff in the first couple of minutes that you're going to meet all these guys and these women. And especially if you are American and are down with American history, you know exactly what's going to happen in the thing. So it's this sort of what I call a flat pattern. Like, it doesn't, you know, you're not waiting to hear what's going to happen next.
Right.
Because you know what's going to happen next, because everybody knows that, Lincoln was shot, and everybody knows that JFK was shot and that kind of thing. As soon as you hear these names, then depending on how much American history you know, although...
Well, yeah, I was going to say maybe like William McKinley, not so much. James Garfield, no one actually knows them. So
maybe not.
It's maybe a bit of a tense.
I only know Garfield because his name is Garfield.
Yeah.
And the two women, they were interesting ones. I loved their scene.
Yeah.
With the Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Their scenes always play the best. They always play like gangbusters.
Oh, man. That's really, really fun stuff. And the shit song where she's searching for a gun.
Yeah, with her purse.
Yeah. And it's not even a whole song. It's like a little segue inside of a big group number. That was lovely.
I saw you because we were a few rows behind you. I saw you. Sometimes I like to watch people that I'm with watch things.
Yeah.
And I saw you laughing at that. It's partly because I'm always like nervous. I'm like, oh, I hope they're having a good time. So when I saw you like laughing out loud at the purse part, I was like, okay, good.
Yeah. I mean, because Sondheim is so funny. And there are still, you know, like my one other Sondheim experience, which is weirdly being in it when I was 20. There are lyrics from that musical that, like, I never got sick of hearing. Like, his wordplay is so good, the way that he, you know, matches the rhythm and the wordplay, and you know, that it can be written in 1990 and still be seriously, seriously funny now. So
yeah, and that was. Do you know Judy Kuhn, who was playing Sarah Jane Moore? Are you familiar?
No,
with her at
no,
all?
I don't know her.
She was in the original, well, not the original, but she was in Sunset Boulevard on Broadway.
Oh, okay.
And she was the singing voice of Pocahontas.
Oh, my God.
I know, right?
Oh, so, my God.
Just around the river bend.
Oh, my God. Why are you telling me this now? Because when we were walking away from the theater, we walked past her. If I'd known she was the voice of Pocahontas, I would have said something.
I know. I didn't. Oh, I'd forgotten all of the people that were in this. So until she came on stage, I was like, oh, right. Fucking Judy Coon is in this.
That is so meaningful. That's blowing my mind.
Oh, I know. Okay, well, at least you noticed that we walked by her. I guess that's something.
Well, yeah. Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah, but you know how many Disney assholes are out there? I'm sure she's heard it plenty.
Yeah. But she hasn't heard it from me.
That's true. That would have made the difference.
You could have been friends with her.
All right.
You were just getting a little Sam Bick here.
All right.
Just record a tape for her.
I will.
Anyway, so about the production history, it premiered at the end of 1990 at Playwrights Horizons. It was not a big hit. By that point, people had a really ambivalent relationship to Sondheim. He had, after his incredible run in the 70s, he had done Sunday in the Park, won the Pulitzer for that, which made a lot of people jealous. And then he had Into the Woods, which was a minor hit, but it was the same year as Phantom of the Opera and, didn't do as well as it could have. But this was him really, I guess, well, Sunday in the Park with George had premiered at Playwrights Horizons as well. So he had already had experience off Broadway. But Assassins was really mixed reviews, just like Lincoln. Oh, yeah, I wanted to flag that too. This has one of my favorite Sondheim couplets, in the Ballad of Booth, when he says, "But traitors don't get jeers and boos, just visits to their graves. While Lincoln, who got mixed reviews because of you, John, now gets only raves."
Yep.
That line tickles me to no end, not just because of the tight and incredible wordplay,
yeah,
but it's the way he throws in but traitors don't just get jeers and boos, not visits to their graves. While Lincoln, who got mixed reviews, so now that it should be the part that rhymes with just visits to their graves, but he inserts in there because of you, John.
Yeah.
Then goes back to the rhyme scheme, and it gives me chills.
Even
every time I hear it.
It's like he's invasive in, he's like protruding in the
itself. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. Like the rhyme itself is coming apart at the seams. So
I really think that Sondheim is one of those creators who, like, they invented a new kind of narrative math around things and all of this stuff was flying around right when he died. Everybody was coming out going, there's nothing like the patterns that Sondheim writes into songs. And again, I remember that from the experience. The opening number of Company, which is the show that I did, I still listen to that song and remember the experience of learning that opening number. And it's like math, like the way you have to, the way you have to ride the pattern as a group of people is extremely difficult, firstly, and you have to listen so, so closely. And it sort of doesn't go where you instinctively think it's going to. It goes somewhere much better every single time. And, the one, I don't remember the lyric as clearly as you remembered that coupling, but there's an early Wilkes song in Assassins where it's something like, you think I'm a traitor, but you'll understand it later. And just
call me dirty traitor. They will understand me later. No, the country is not what it was.
Exactly. But the way that those words ride the tone, and he goes up on the later kind of thing.
Yeah.
It is for some reason, just gets you in a way that other people's writing doesn't. And I think that's just Sondheim. He had this really granular look at how the patterns of the words and the tones and the rhythm worked that no one else does. I think.
Yeah, and he often got accused of being anti-emotional, but that's bullshit.
Nah.
He used the math to go right to that place, to bypass the bullshit other people had to throw in.
Yeah.
But in the case of, and I got it wrong, I need to repent, it's "let them cry, dirty traitor. They will understand me later."
So yeah.
Forgive me.
I think
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that in the lovely testaments that were printed after he died, Mandy Patinkin, I think, said this thing. He said, "There's one Shakespeare and there's one Sondheim," and that's true. Mm-hmm. I think. I mean, you would know better than me. You know his body of work better than me. But that rang true, I think, for me.
I've heard, I've heard him say that live in concert as well. That's kind of the drum he's been beating since the '80s, and
good.
He's not
wrong.
I'm
just catching up.
if there's anyone, yeah, I can't think of anyone who for who it fits better.
Yeah.
But and in the case of the opening number of Company, it is literal math, because you know the part near the end when it, you know, when you, everyone goes, we love, you know, like forever.
Yes, yes.
You know,
yes,
that the length of that was based, it was based only on how long it took everyone to get across Boris Aronson's set. So it's literally based on that. How, yeah, because there were like elevators, and there's an elevator and staircases. So it literally just was like, okay, tell me how long you need it. So now generations of performers have been tortured with, we love.
So thank literal you for math. Telling me that. Oh, that makes so much sense. We never knew why we had to hold that note for so long. We're on this tiny stage.
Yeah. We get it. You love him.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
anyway, so yeah, back to the production history. So then the first Gulf War started right in the middle of its run.
Ooh.
So it suddenly became topical in a way. And that was, you know, that was back when wars still actually like mattered and people cared and stuff like that. But so that it never transferred. I think they were trying to transfer it to Broadway, but because it was deemed like too hot, you know, too topical with the guns and the violence and stuff in the wake of that. Then it played at Don Mar in like 92 and directed by Sam Mendes. And that was the song, the penultimate song, Something Just Broke, you know, when the people are talking about where they were, which I actually hate, I think is one of his worst songs.
Ooh.
That was added in for that production because he felt that, you know, they had done How I Saved Roosevelt, in which they made fun of what is the word I'm looking for?
Passerby, standby.
But it's not. Yeah, no, that's the words I started saying. Anyway, that made fun of the people, the common man. You know, that's the only time we hear their voice. So he wanted to balance that out and with at the end and show them suffering or, you know, show the pathos of. But I just, for me personally, it kills the moment, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald takes aim, fires, and then there's that incredible moment where the piano, where the orchestra just comes in, you know, just that loud note that I was bawling, of course, but I've always loved that part. And then it's, you know, remember it plays the waltz theme again from the beginning. And then normally it goes right into Everybody's Got the Right again, which I think is just perfect. But now they break it up with that. I don't know. What did you guys think about that song, Something Just Broke? Did you find it moving?
It was, I think it happened at a point for me where I was starting to think, wow, there's a lot of singing in this show. Stupidest thought to have ever during musical, but I remember thinking there's like, oh, this they've given up the talking bits. Now it's just going to be singing. So I don't actually really remember it. I don't remember when that happened.
Yeah, it's not memorable. It doesn't go anywhere interesting.
Yeah, there you go. I didn't remember it.
The only part I remember from that song specifically is the person who plays Emma Goldman walking across the stage.
Ooh, yeah, she was rough. She was kind of the weak link for me. And I realized later she was the understudy.
Yeah, she was.
Oh, that's – oh, okay, we can let her off the hook. Yeah, there was far too much poignancy going on in that performance. It was a bit distracting.
Yeah, from the very beginning. And that's part of my – also another issue I have with John Doyle is he doesn't really know where how to – no, it's not that he doesn't know. It's just there his tend to be stripped of emotion, and then when he tries to throw it in, it comes off as –
shallow and pedantic.
No, but sure. But you know, like you saw it, the choreography, all of that, there was a lot of solemn walking around in patterns, you know.
Yeah.
And that's just not, unless you're a Japanese like kabuki performer, master exactly, who has been training for the last 6 decades.
Yeah.
That shit is just not interesting.
Those guys, they're the only ones who are allowed to do a slow walk across the stage whenever.
Yes, there it is.
Exactly. But,
oh God, Westerners doing this. It's just like, everyone stop that. There should be just stop
it's
doing the
not,
slow walk.
It always takes me out. It never is emotional. Anyway. Yeah. So then they plant the Broadway. It was finally going to premiere on Broadway in 2001, and a little thing called 9/11 happened.
Hey.
And again, it was like too controversial. It was too hot for Broadway.
Yeah.
So then it finally opened in 2004, and actually Dingle Mommy and I saw that one on our honeymoon.
Yeah.
Mm.
At Studio 54. And it was good. Neil Patrick Harris played the balladeer / Lee Harvey Oswald, which is an interesting choice.
Nutty.
And I remember the coolest part of that was they, so you know the Zapruder film, the like the one bit of visual evidence they have from the JFK assassination. It was that like amateur footage that a guy took, of the car. That's they projected that onto his, what?
Was that on the circle? Was that playing on the circle?
Was there footage of like the car?
Yeah, and him getting shot.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Then yeah, probably.
And there was like someone literally like hanging onto the back of the car.
Yeah, that was their like security guy, like trying to like, yeah, that's the Zapruder film. In the Broadway one, so he was wearing that white T-shirt. They projected it directly onto his chest, which was pretty interesting.
That was cool.
This is also the more guns than I've ever seen on stage. I've only just realized that.
Yeah. What was that like? Because
for
us, it's not that weird. We're used to guns everywhere all the time. It's more.
Well, I feel like in a sort of a similar and different way to edit that out. That was the best thing I've said so far. It's both similar and different.
Ooh, provocative.
Profound. Glad we got this lady on.
Compare and contrast.
Yeah. The thing I said earlier about mobile phones being anti-theater and anti-magic, guns on stage do a really specific thing. And you know, the best look at this, I think, is probably Chekhov. When the gun comes out, it's quite significant. Yeah. You know, there's going to be Chekhov's a gun coming, and it finally does. And then you know, the something's going to happen after the gun. Not necessarily that someone's going to get shot or not shot. It's just that dramatically, that's a trigger for you know the audience, like, oh, the gun's out, kind of thing. Mm. And with this show, there's the gun's out in the first 35 seconds. And there are so many guns. Everybody has a gun. The guns are being pointed around the room a lot. The assassination shots were always shot backwards, away from the audience, interestingly, towards the band. But something that I couldn't get out of my head is that we do have that recent horrific story of the filmmaker who died with a prop gun. So yeah. I kept looking at the stage going, are they prop guns? And it made me uneasy. I was like, what kind of gun is that? And I had to tell myself they wouldn't use a loadable gun on a stage because it doesn't need to go off. Like they don't need to see the smoke and sound coming from that gun. So, you know, they wouldn't be the same guns they'd use on a film set. But that actually crossed my mind. I was like, whoa, there's guns being pointed around. Dingle, what did you think about the gun thing? You said something directly after the show yesterday before we got silenced by your dad. about how you felt when the guns were swinging around the room and you had a gun pointed at you from the stage. How did that make you feel?
Yeah, I agree. It also was a little bit stressful because I was at the exact center of the stage and at the exact perfect height so that whenever they point a gun, it's directly at my head.
Yeah.
And on top of that, so I was like, that also was causing me a lot of stress. And on top of that, that also meant I got stared a lot at by the actors.
Because like, they were getting a reaction from you.
Yeah, but exactly.
Maybe do you think that, I mean, I don't think any theater maker would want us to look at a stage full of guns and feel comfortable and relaxed about that. Is that a part of it?
Yeah.
That like we're going to wave these weapons around the room and you might find yourself with it being pointed at you and we don't want you to feel comfortable about that. There's something about the stress underneath that maybe that's a part of the experience of seeing assassins is that you will have a gun pointed at you at some point.
I have a threefold response to that.
Oh, he's been preparing.
So on their website, at least, I was surprised, maybe it was posted in the lobby. I didn't notice. They had a lengthy statement about the guns, about, I think they named the prop master or the person who was in charge of them, how they were, the type of gun they were, how there was no chance of them, you know, being loaded or shot and all the safety precautions. It's like a pretty lengthy statement that I noticed, but it was only on the website. I was just looking now at the little program that they hand out, little single page thing. It's probably in the full digital program. Maybe,
no, it wasn't. Anyway. I read the digital program. It's not in there, I don't think. Wait, we'll have to verify this afterwards and cut this whole thing out if that's true.
Well, regardless, it's still – no, because who reads – not everyone reads the program. Like there's one thing I learned as a dramaturg is no one actually reads the shit that you put your heart and soul into making.
No.
So that's one.
Yeah.
Two is I did – speaking of dramaturgy, I dramaturged a production of All My Sons when I was at the University of Utah, which of course famously ends with – the father's suicide by gun. Remember? Yeah. Do you remember that? We saw All My Sons, you remember? On Broadway, he was, it's like World War II, and he runs a factory where they...
Where they make the airplanes and stuff.
So, but the director did not want to have the standard warning about gunshot because he wanted it, you know, he didn't want to give it away. He didn't want to ruin the moment. And there were some fights, you know, they went back and forth, but the director won. And in one performance of that, a Vietnam vet who was in the audience, who didn't know the play, had a severe trauma response to the gunshot. And basically, I don't think he passed out, but he may have passed out like in the aisle trying to leave the theater or something. Anyway, it was bad.
Yeah.
So you're really playing with fire, literally, when that happens.
You are, but then...
go ahead.
Thirdly, go and finish your point.
Yeah. So one of the best productions I ever saw of this play was actually at Little Columbia Basin College in Pasco, Washington, when I was in high school. So it was just this local college production. Maybe it's because I hadn't seen much real theater at that point, but I just remember being so enthralled by it to the point where, you know, when they're shooting the Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket, it was like dancing when they were shooting it. Like it was so,
whoa.
It's always bothered me ever since when they shoot at it and it doesn't move.
Yeah.
Like it's theater. We're suspending our disbelief, all of that. But I'm always like, if fucking CBC in Pasco, Washington can make the bucket of chicken dance, why isn't your chicken dancing?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm with you on that.
Anyway, but so that part in the gun song, when Gateau says, "What a wonder is a gun. What a versatile invention. First of all, when you have a gun," and then he waves it around, you know,
and then
says, "Everybody pays attention." At that moment, I remember the guy playing Gateau took his time. You know, it was a small auditorium, but he basically went around and pointed that gun at almost everyone in the audience. Well, that's how I remember it. It may have been more of a straight line.
Yeah.
But then, so then the line, "Everybody pays attention," like we just like laughed so hard at because it was, A, it's funny. It really like built to the punchline, but it was such a relief because you're like,
yeah.
Oh God, is he going to shoot us? He's going to shoot us.
Yeah. I don't think, and it's, it's interesting with all of the other kind of bits that were laid on by the director in this show, like you said before, that's one thing that I don't think they made a decision about. I don't think that the gun waving was considered. And I remember in that bit that I loved where she was searching for a gun in her handbag and she pulled out everything else but a gun. She's like,
"No, not the shoe." Well, actually, the shoe was too.
"This was on sale." "No, not the shoe." "Well, the shoe was too." Shit. The way that actress said shit, I will love her till the end of time.
Pocahontas.
The way Pocahontas said shit. But yeah, so when she pulled out that hairbrush, I was like, oh, right, that's an object that's not a gun that she's saying is a gun, but mistaking for a gun. And then sort of like my theater brain turns on. And I'm like, oh, yeah, and that's what you do. Like on stage, you say this is a thing even though it's not a thing. But in this show, it's a really important – there's no way of doing assassins and replacing the guns with something else. You have to have those things on the stage.
Yeah, like fingers? I don't think so.
Yeah, fingers, hairbrushes, water pistols. Like, no, it's important. It's a show about how people shot presidents with guns. So you need to have them on there. And I don't – yeah, I'm not – I didn't whiff anywhere in there that the director had made a specific choice about or that they'd even been – like – I mean, how many choices can you make about that? You either wave them or you don't. You point them at the audience or you don't. But
I don't know. I think it was considered. I think they just chickened out. I think they took the safe path because, well, so this production as well, this was supposed to be on 2 years ago. This cast was announced in fall of 2019.
Whoa.
Oh, wow.
So it's, you know, you probably get the feeling too that there's so much, this moment is so pregnant and so full of just everything right now that it's like how far again this play becomes almost too hot for production. Like how far do we want to push, how like is this really the right moment to be provoking this liberal, probably upper middle class New York City audience
about guns? It just feels like this weird cultural tick whenever America capsizes, you stage assassins and see what happens.
Well, it's one of those shows that's never not it's never not a good moment for it.
Yeah.
I mean, especially, and this was, you know, we didn't we didn't acknowledge gun violence in 1990. They were so far ahead of the curve on this.
Yeah.
That it's, you know, luckily one of the best things about 2020 in America was there were no school shootings. There were almost no school shootings.
Well, I didn't know that.
Because no one was at school. Yeah.
Oh,
the school stopped, so the school shooting stopped, and it was great. We weren't reading about a new school shooting every other week, you know?
Oh, you're so right. That's awful.
Yeah. So you're one of the silver linings. But but gun crime and murder and all of that increased in New York City.
Yeah.
Because everyone was stuck at home. Well, not everyone. The people who could afford to were stuck at home. So there's this – so that's – you know, so this play just really – and I actually attribute most of it to the librettist, John Weidman. He's got such a brilliant political mind. He also wrote the book for Pacific Overtures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's so insightful beyond being just an amazing comic talent. You know, those scenes between Squeaky Fromm and Sarah Jane Moore are just so funny when she's like, did you know he was the son of God? She was like, absolutely.
That is a really, really good scene. It's really funny.
Just picking for example, like when Czolgosz meets Emma Goldman, you know, which actually is usually a much more affecting scene. But again, because I think it was the understudy, you know, something was missing.
Yeah.
But just the moments that he picks, just this little pick and mix of moments, you know, it's just so effective and so wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm still hung up on what, on the gun thing and how just dramaturgically how you deal with that, because you're totally right. There's no way there wasn't a conversation with the company and in the making of the thing as to what are we doing with these guns, or maybe there wasn't. I don't know. But also the fact is, presidents die by gunshot in this country because people have guns in this country.
Yeah.
And I'm still sitting in New York while we're having this conversation. So by this country, I mean literally the one I've sat in, that all three of us have sat in. And that is a part of that story. I mean, no Australian prime ministers have been assassinated. They just haven't. There has been gun massacre in Australia.
But then they responded to that with strict gun laws, and there haven't been any more.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing is, like, might those presidents still be alive were it not for — the answer is yes, because they'd have to get them with a crossbow. And not that many people are good with a crossbow. I don't know, but that it is a part of this. It is a part of the story, I think, and maybe I'm just saying that as an outsider to American culture, that it's a part of the story that these assassins succeeded in assassinating because they had access to firearms. And maybe it overburdens the thing if you try and put that in. If you try and put that thought on the stage, maybe the whole thing falls over. I don't know. I don't know how you would do that, but it's just, you know, as a result of talking this through now, I'm like, oh yeah, that really is the thing.
For me, it's, you just have to, it works best. The ones that I've seen that have worked the best, that one at CBC and the one at the Meunier Chocolate Factory in London, it works best when you just trust the material. And this is what sort of annoys me about John Doyle, who has for some reason become the Sondheim interpreter of the 21st century.
Yeah, right.
On the strength of his — did you ever see any of his like actor musician ones that he did, like his Sweeney Todd or —
no, well, as discussed, well, I've not — this is the only one I've seen. Sondheim in history.
Yeah. Anyway, he works against the material often in such — this is what he, you know, we saw his Pacific Overtures that he did about four or five years ago. And it was the same thing. He gutted the material, you know, he pares it down. And this, at least, luckily, it's a short piece, so he didn't have to change it. But he guts the material and streamlines it in a way that really just tears the heart right out of it.
Yeah.
When so the one at Meunier, which I did want to just mention because it was such a thrilling experience, it was Jamie Lloyd. You know Jamie Lloyd, right?
Do I? No. Do I?
He did. He was really hot when I was in London. He did The Ruling Class with James McAvoy at Trafalgar Studios. He did that Urinetown that was on, that was incredible, that was dark and bloody. And, you know, he often — his stuff is — I think he did The Hamlet with Benedict Cumberbatch, but I think — but don't hold that against him.
Yeah.
Wow.
You see so much more theater than me anyway. So yeah, carry on.
I'm sure you've seen something that he's done over the years, because he's always working there. Anyway, so this is the Meunier Chocolate Factory, which — have you ever been to, Mel?
In London?
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's such a great space because it's in a basement. So it's like, which is a perfect space for something like this because it's already scary and dark.
Yeah.
You know? And so what he did is it always takes place in like a playground, like a carnival play area, like playground, not playground, but you know, like a midway type thing is always anyway with like the shooting games and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was more like an abandoned carnival. Mm. The main set piece was this giant glowing clown head thing.
No.
Yeah, which the proprietor was apparently hiding in before people started coming in because he came out of it at the beginning. Uh-huh. And he had Joker makeup on, kind of. Or like in like a Rob Zombie, like House of a Thousand Corpses type. Mm-hmm. And it was the whole thing played like they were almost, even though they were usually wearing the normal period appropriate clothes, it treated them as like supervillains in a comic book.
That's yeah. Cool.
And it was fucking brilliant because it was terrifying. It leaned into the fact that it's fucking terrifying to have a gun pointing at your face.
Yeah.
And like, and because it's a really small and sort of immersive space, you really feel that terror. And it didn't destroy the comic moments. Like sometimes it can happen when you overplay the terror and the fear, but it was utterly thrilling. And like, so Aaron Tveit, who's hot, he played Booth. He suicided like right in front of me, like basically like landed on my feet. And I was like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. But the point is you trust the material, which I find too often in New York, people, for whatever reason, I don't know, you know, the theater making culture in New York better than I do, Mel, but there's always this this need to push back against the material, to try to outsmart it or one up it in a way
that I tend
to find really counterproductive and uninteresting.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all I got to say about that.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to think of a punchy response to that. Because I think like on the gun thing in Assassins, whether or not you feel like that material has been thematically milked for, I mean, that prop, that literal object, whether or not you think that object has been considered in one way or another by the makers of that production or whatever production, where it leads back to is the conversation around American culture, which is that there are just like firearms or ordinary objects. Like maybe putting a firearm on stage is kind of putting a mobile phone on stage. I don't know. Yeah. It was really amazing. The final image, the projected image just before the lights went down of the riot at the Capitol. That was like slightly on, maybe a bit on the nose.
Wait,
maybe
what?
Did you not see that?
Yeah, there were.
What? Like on the Target projection?
Oh my
screen?
God, you didn't see that? You were too busy looking at Hot Wilkes. Yeah. There was.
I did not see that.
They projected an image of the right of the mob hanging off the front of the Capitol building. It wasn't there for very long, but it was a nice full stop.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't know how I feel about that. I'm not sure. That feels almost a bit too on the nose for me.
Well, yeah. But I mean, that happened since the production was planned, right? That happened in the the stasis.
A year ago. And it's almost exactly a year ago. Wow, I did not see that.
Yeah.
Actually,
I mean,
I was probably looking at SpongeBob. He's the one that I think is hot.
Yeah, y'all. I was the only person paying attention in that moment. They did. He projected.
Cute. Yeah.
They projected that at the end, which, yeah, it's kind of on the nose. It's kind of a bit obvious, but that doesn't make it wrong, I think.
I agree. You got to say something. I think audiences demand it.
Yeah.
So at the very least, they feel like
they learned
they're doing something, you know?
Yeah.
Like just to build that sense of community, that us versus them. I don't know.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm. Well,
wow.
Sadly, Dinglemary has to start. His D&D session starts in a few minutes, so I think we're going to have to call it there.
All right.
Any final brief wrapping up thoughts from anyone besides SpongeBob is hot?
I think the Evita joke was made when he was recording his tape to Leonard Bernstein.
Oh, okay.
And he made a comment about Evita. And then the musicians played a little bit of Evita, and then he finished his tape. And then as they segued into the next vignette, they played some music from Evita, but kind of weird.
I thought that was America. Oh, it was America from West Side Story.
Oh. shoe.
Which makes more sense. Yeah, got it. Yeah, because he's talking to Leonard Bernstein, who's the composer of West Side Story.
Got it.
All right, so that's on me and for not educating you enough in your musical theater history education. No, it's nothing to be sorry about. That's fine. Just because you thought they were saying everybody's got the right to bear dreams,
which is a good line. I'm sticking to that line.
That is good. All right, well, Mel, as always, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I'm glad we got to see you even for at least a couple hours.
Wasn't it magical? Thank you for having me, you guys. I'm glad I caught you while I was in town.
Can people find you anywhere online? Do you want people to find you online?
Well, yeah, you can try. You can have you won't have to try very hard. Because all you have to do is go to signalhouseedition.org. No, hang on. I always get that URL wrong. I'm going to give you that soundbite again.
No, it is. It's signalhouseedition.org because I used to say the signalhouseedition.org.
All right. So sure all you have to do is go to signalhouseedition.org.
And all you have to do is Signal House Edition.
signalhouseedition.org. Yeah, so go there and you can check us out there.
Okay, fabulous. Anything else you want to say, Dingle Mary? Okay, well, that's been our episode. Thank you for listening. Join us for an all new closet practice on Monday.
Why do I expect anything else? Why do I expect freedom?
The eternal and I don't know.
I will not be silenced. I'm going to shoot the president now.
Nobody would listen.
And also to promote sales of my new book.
Yes. Watch this space. Dingle Mary, ambassador to France. All right. Thanks, Mel. Thanks, everyone. See you next time.
Bye.
This has been another House of Barbarism podcast, written, recorded, edited, and produced by Document of Barbarism, your friendly neighborhood mountain man fairy princess. Remember, there is no document of civilization which is not, at the same time, a Documenta Barbarism. Mwah.